Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, rocked by protests and police crackdowns following a contested presidential election, what is going on in Belarus? Doug Becker explores the history and the likelihood of a continuation of the Lukashenko dictatorship.
I'm Doug Becker. On August the 9th, 2020, Belarusian voters went to the polls in a presidential election. Longtime President Alexander Lukashenko, who has governed the nation since 1994 and is often called Europe's last dictator, claimed victory. In the weeks leading up to the election, Lukashenko had detained several opposition leaders, including Sergei Tikhanovsky. His wife, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, announced she would stand for the office, and opposition parties rallied behind her candidacy to unseat Lukashenko. Lukashenko announced he had won the election with a reported 80%+ of the vote. This has been contested not only by Belarusian opposition, but by most election observers and outside powers. Tikhanovskaya has declared she won approximately 60% of the vote. Since the election, the nation has been rocked by protests and general work strikes, while the government has violently cracked down on the protests, detaining thousands, injuring hundreds, and killing at least three. In response, the protests have grown in size and frequency. On today's show, we will examine the history of Belarus, the 2020 presidential election and the protests, and the likelihood of the continuation of the Lukashenko dictatorship. Our guests today are Margarita Balmaseda, Professor of Diplomacy and International Relations at Seton Hall University. She is also an associate of the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies and of the Ukrainian Research Institute at Harvard University. She is the author of several books and articles, including Living the High Life in Minsk, Russian Energy Rents, Domestic Populism, and Belarus's Impending Crisis. And Tatiana Kulikevich, lecturer at the University of South Florida and research fellow at the USF Institute on Russia. She is the author of 20 Years in the Making, Understanding the Difficulty for Change in Belarus. First, Professor Balmaseda, could you give us a synopsis, a breakdown of the events over the course of, say, the last month in Belarus, including the election?
First of all, it's wonderful to be here, and it's wonderful to be discussing with Dr. Kulikevich, whose work I know and admire, and I hope that we will have a very good discussion and will bring Belarus closer to the American public, because that is very, very much needed. So, as you mentioned, on August 9, there were presidential elections in Belarus. Actually, the voting had started earlier, because it is now in Belarus already a very well-seated tradition to start early voting, more than a week before the elections. We'll get to discuss that a bit later. Soon after the elections, the government declared Lukashenko had won by over 86%. And immediately, spontaneous protests started. The leader of the movement that is now in everybody's lips, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, was basically pressured to leave the country within 24 hours and fled to Lithuania, where her children were already located. Since then, you have seen every day larger and larger protest movements, not only in Minsk, but other parts of the country. Very significantly, these are not simply protests in the street, but you have seen strikes, especially strikes in very important state owned companies that bring a lot of foreign currency to the state. And there has been the creation of a transition committee to try to lead to a dialogue with the government. What is very significant is that there has been very, very strong repression, even if compared with previous protests after the elections. And there has been even the inkling that there might be a role for Russian, I don't know whether to call them peacekeeping operations or Russian security forces in Belarus. So The situation has continued to become more and more tense. And for the very first time in my memory, Lukashenko had to experience firsthand the rejection of the people. He went to a very important company in Minsk to address the workers a week ago. He expected that his presence would quell the cries and the protest. And on the contrary, in his very face, people started chanting, Uhadi, Uhadi, leave, leave power. And he just probably saw his world collapse at that time.
Professor Kulikevich, sort of what conditions kind of led to this position where the president, where Lukashenko's position has become so much more precarious politically?
The pleasure is all mine, Dr. Balmaced. And, you know, I'm happy to be here. The situation started a little kind of over 2 years ago, maybe longer, when Lukashenko got into tensions with Russia over gas prices. And, you know, they couldn't resolve the economic situation with gas prices, and that started weakening the economy, which he was benefiting over years by getting cheap subsidies. Dr. Balmaseda wrote the book about that. And more kind of closer to the election, with weak economy and tensions with Russia, Lukashenko tried to improve his relationship with the West to kind of, you know, balance Russia. And we saw that Mike Pompeo visited the country in February, and the relationship with the European Union was improving. However, unexpectedly, COVID-19 struck, and Lukashenko could not afford economically, let's say, to acknowledge existence of the virus, and tried to joke it out by saying that people should drink vodka, go to sauna, drive a tractor, and all kinds of sentences like that. And people were kind of, you know, didn't have a choice but to organize themselves and deal with the pandemic on their own. The so-called grassroots movement kind of took roots. And people, you know, were disappointed that the government was just, you know, advising to play hockey and saying the virus, do you see the virus? I don't. So it does not exist, basically. So they were not happy with the economy. They were not happy with the virus situation, you know, the ignorance of that by the government. And closer to the election, new faces appeared who wanted to run for the election. So why is that new? Because over the years, over 26 years, Lukashenko has been suppressing the opposition, which people were not even, you know, recognizing that so-called. So, I mean, in a sense, they even call this opposition old opposition. So new faces were new, fresh air, we can say, to all people. We are talking about the banker Viktor Babaryka, and we are talking about the blogger Sergei Tikhanovsky, and we are talking about the former diplomat and the founder of the IT park, Information Technologies Park, Valery Tsepkala, and people started gathering around these new people. So, and that where kind of, you know, where we were going to the election. So people were not happy already. And Lukashenko started removing the heads of the movement, the people who had potential to gather people around them. So he imprisoned the banker, Viktor Babaryka. He imprisoned the blogger, Sergei Tikhanovsky. And he was kind of had a plan for Valery Tsepkala, for this person, he did not, recognize the signatures to register him as a candidate. So, as was mentioned at the beginning, the wife, the person, housewife, former teacher with no political experience, out of love for her husband, where kind of didn't have a chance, didn't have a choice, I mean, but to go and register as a presidential candidate, and Lukashenko basically allowed her to go for it.
Let's talk a bit about that question. This Svetlana Tikhanovskaya not only has never been involved in politics, but really seemed to have not really had much of a public profile at all. And that seems to be at least somewhat representative that we have all these new figures. So how much of this is really generational, Professor Balmaseda, in that this is really about new political classes rising up and demanding democratization?
I totally agree that, especially the point made by Tatiana concerning how the need for self-organization in the face of a COVID that was ignored by the state led to the emergence of new faces. However, I do want to call for a little bit of caution in terms of terming Svetlana Tikhanovskaya a leader. She said so many times, I am just a prastaya baba. I don't know whether she used those words. I am a wife, a mother. My children are the most important thing in my life. I just want to be a transitional figure. So in terms of gender relations, I am a little bit concerned about her statements, but I'll leave that aside for the moment. She very clearly does not see herself as a leader, and she has even said this in very beautiful words. History put me reluctantly as the leader of a revolution that I did not want or call for. And she has always said that all she wants is for her victory to be acknowledged and to call for new elections.
Professor Kulikevich.
I agree with Margarita here, but also kind of to add, she never considered herself as a leader, and she was very clear about that. She called herself a symbol. Her job, as she saw it and as she portrayed herself, was to kind of, you know, serve as a person, as a symbol for people to get through this transitional phase to get to new elections. So her initial kind of hope was to free political prisoners, to free economic prisoners. And she only started calling herself a leader when she got into exile, where she started being more safe. And I think there were people around her who explained to her that that's her job right now. And people are hoping, people are relying on her. But that happened after the elections, after. Before that, it was clear that she was there not by even her choice at all. And Lukashenko, I think, underestimated her because of his misogyny. He didn't think, like, you know, she had a chance, because he said that women, it's not a woman's job to be a president. The woman cannot handle this job. That's what he, like, literally said.
Yes, I do remember at one point he said he wasn't concerned at all about losing to her because Belarusians would never elect a woman. And she certainly seems to have been much more positioned as a symbol than necessarily as a, you know, directly, I suppose, as a political figure. Now, shifting gears a little bit, Margarita, clearly, if we're talking about a country like Belarus, its neighbors will play a pretty substantial role in these events as they unfold. The first that clearly comes to mind is Russia. What has Russia's position been? What is Putin's relationship with Lukashenko? And what really are Russian interests as they're watching these events unfold?
We could have a very long separate discussion on this topic. To say it in a nutshell, one topic I have been discussing for almost 20 years is that the Western view of Lukashenko as pro-Russian since the beginning is a very, it's a problematic one because it's not fully accurate. What we have seen basically since Lukashenko became president in 1994, or especially since 1997, is a kind of strange dance between Lukashenko and Russia, be it with Yeltsin, be it with other leaders, where Lukashenko has used the idea or the hope or the symbol of integration with Russia. And in fact, they have on paper a union state, which doesn't really exist in reality, as a way to extract different political favors, either from the Russian leadership, from regional leaders, to gain public relation points with different publics in Russia and Belarus. Now, what is Russia's longstanding interest concerning Belarus? Well, I would say we can talk about three different levels of interest. First, at a grassroots level, many people in Russia would not want to see the idea of quote unquote losing Belarus, because Belarus was culturally and in the social conceptualization very much tied to Russia in the mind of common Russian citizens. Secondly, Belarus, for good or for bad, has played and has very skillfully played the role of Russia's quote unquote defense on the West, first line of defense against NATO or only ally vis-a-vis NATO. And finally, there are some economic interests that are linked to Belarus. Obviously, Mr. Putin would like a closer, I wouldn't say a closer relationship, but he would like the Belarusian leadership to more closely follow his lead concerning, for example, Ukraine, concerning the desire for recognition of Russian quote-unquote sovereignty over Crimea. He has not gotten that. In the last few years, Lukashenko, perhaps fearing Russian intervention in Belarus, has taken actually more national positions. So it's a very complex situation where we fear Russia may decide to intervene. We fear Lukashenko may be tempted to allow that intervention, but Lukashenko himself knows that any real union with Russia or any real Russian presence, military presence in Belarus would mean the end of his power. So this is a very, very complex relationship and has been for the last 20 years, 23 years at least.
Tatiana?
I wanted to add to that, just get into the protests right now. Just want to kind of point to the fact that protests are not pro-European Union or pro-West, let's say, or like against Russia or pro-Russia and against the West. It's not. It's not the protest against geopolitical, you know, neighbors. The protest is within the country against the government. So in terms of Russia, it's not in the interest of Putin to alienate the people who are not against him at the moment as well. So that also is on his mind. However, I agree that, yes, he wants to weaken Lukashenko in this situation because he understands that Lukashenko lost all leverage with the West by beating people, and he already, you know, did enough for sanctions and for the backlash from the West, for ruining all the relationships that he has been working at for the past 6-7 years after the Crimea situation. That's gone already, and he has no other kind of, you know, ally except Russia. Or if we go further, even that might be China. But other than that.
And it seems to me there's been a lot of conversation about the way in which Russia's relationship with Ukraine is helping to frame an understanding of both Russia's interests, but even more importantly, their strategy in Belarus. That, first of all, Lukashenko has seen what an opposition to Putin has meant for Ukrainian leadership and their reactions, but Putin also understands that if people are taking to the streets and protesting, whether or not he backs the government or backs the protesters, I guess at one level I imagine he's sitting and watching and seeing if the protesters are going to be successful. Because he sure would like to be the one responsible for bringing about a new government, if a new government actually develops. But I guess the question here, though, is how much has Russian relations with Ukraine helped to frame the potential for Russian intervention in Belarus, kind of teaching certain lessons about Russian intervention on countries on their border? I'll ask Margarita. I'll ask you first.
Yes, that's a very interesting question, very complex one. It changes the framing of that possible intervention because nobody is naive anymore, not even Lukashenko. He will not even in his pro-Russian beliefs, he is very wary of a possible Russian intervention. Nobody can see the world anymore as we saw it before 2014. So in that sense, it totally frames the situation. But I do want to add one small point here. There is also another connection between what is happening in Belarus, what is happening in Ukraine, and Russian strategy. And that is the connection with what is happening domestically in Russia with the protests going on in Russia now in the Far East, in Khabarovsk. Those people are protesting against Putin, but for Belarus as well. And I think Putin is very worried about what the events in Belarus may mean for events in Russia. And let me leave it at here. Tatiana would like to follow up on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I heard about these protests. Don't know terribly much about what's going on. What's the nature of the protests that are going on in Russia?
Well, the protests in Russia are against the removal of their governor, and they want the governor back. But what's interesting is that the protests have been going on for a month, for 40 plus days. I think maybe like about 50, I didn't count. I know they were 40 maybe a week ago, 43 maybe. But what's interesting is that Lukashenko and Putin and many, many people were taken by surprise by the protests in Belarus. It is very unprecedented situation. You know, everybody's watching. A lot of Belarusians are saying, I cannot sleep. I'm waiting. I'm looking and kind of, you know, analyzing. So everybody knows the poisoning of Navalny. Everybody knows Navalny. People are talking that he was removed to kind of as Lukashenko was removed, the potential leaders who could be at the front of the movement in Belarus. So that's what Putin basically did. That's one of the opinion. But in terms of the relationship to Ukraine. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya and people who gathered around her never attempted to repeat Maidan in Ukraine. That was the rhetoric by Lukashenko. He has been mentioning this since the very beginning. He was saying, I will not allow Maidan in Belarus. That's not going to happen. Don't even dream about it. So from one stance, I agree with Margarita that framed a lot because that's history and we know what happened and everybody was aware and maybe also because of that, opposition and let's say people who are protesting, they are asking and they are insisting on preserving sovereignty of the country and not intervening both Russia and the West. They are saying it's our internal affair. We need to resolve it on our own. If you want to mediate, we will allow everybody to be involved. We are not choosing sides. We want to be in the middle. We want to maintain good relationship with all our neighbors. That's what's going on.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We are discussing the ongoing political crisis in Belarus since its presidential elections early in August. Now, Margarita, we've referenced the political ties between Russia and Belarus and also, you know, potentially military ties. What about the economic ties? What ultimately is Russia's interest in Belarus and what's Belarus's interests with their neighbors? And also considering the importance that energy likely has played, I know there's been quite a bit of disruptions in energy markets. Is that contributing to the instability?
Yes, absolutely. So many people ask, how can Belarus have any impact on Russia or have any kind of blackmail on Russia when it has an economy that is much smaller, obviously, than Russia's, and it's in many ways dependent on Russia? My short answer to this is that blackmail has been much more political than economical. There is a phrase in one of the books by Yuri Dragarust about the there is a story in Russian called Kupi Okop by a, I don't know how to say this in English, brick. If you don't give me 200 rubles for this brick, I will hit you with it. I don't even have the brick, but I will do it. And in many ways, Lukashenko has used the potential for a political blackmail to continue to get economic advantages from Russia. I will get into that in a moment. But also for a period in the 1990s, Belarus was extremely important for Russian oil producers who wanted to use Belarus as a way to export oil without having to pay duties to Russia. And they made a huge amount of money on this. So these are ways in which Belarus has been important for specific Russian actors. How the disruption of international energy markets has affected Belarus? It has affected Belarus because the number one source of income for the Belarusian state was the rents they could make from receiving or purchasing Russian oil at a low price and paying no duties on it, refining it, and then selling it to Europe at world prices. This is something that every year gave billions of dollars to the Belarusian state. And when you have very low oil prices, yes, Belarus is paying even less, but the discount it's getting is minimal because the prices are so low to start with, and the price at which those oil products that gasoline and diesel can be sold is lower. So it has affected Belarus tremendously. And is one of the factors that has led to the eroding of Lukashenko's power in the last months. Let's remember that basically since coming to power, Lukashenko has been promising that incomes will reach $1,000, their average salaries will reach $1,000 per month, $800 per month. For a while, he was delivering on that, perhaps not getting to that, but those incomes were increasing. Consumer power was increasing, and that was part of his appeal, and he's not able to deliver on that anymore. So that is one way in which these economies are connected and how it connects with politics.
Yes, Tatiana.
So just to give an example, when the prices of oil changed, you know, in May, Belarus was paying $127 for gas, like basically Russia was selling natural gas to Europe for about $65-$68, while Belarus was paying $127 because there was an agreement, the contracts, and that was not an advantage of to Belarus. Even though when the agreements were made the previous year, the price was good. The price was competitive and even cheap. But when Lukashenko tried to negotiate the $127, Putin didn't want to do that. That's also kind of shows the tensions that they have been having.
So this combination of economic crisis as a result of the energy markets and other things going on, COVID certainly playing a substantial role here, and then I suspect also just the length of time Lukashenko has governed will build pressures for some degree of political reform. You both have suggested that the level of protests have been a bit surprising, and the instability that Lukashenko's currently facing might be a bit surprising. Do you think he's going to survive these protests? Is he going to be able to navigate this, or are his conditions shifting to such a degree that in the near future we're going to see a new president of Belarus? I'll ask Margarita first.
I think a lot will depend on what the nomenclatura and the security apparatus will do. My first feeling was that he will survive, but that his power will weaken more and more. However, when I saw 8 days ago that he made a special point in giving special recognition and special orders and prizes to 300 members of the nomenclatura, especially of the security apparatus, it really gave me to understand that he's not sure about their loyalty. And the fact that some mayors of some Belarusian cities are taking a little bit something different than a purely party true position leads me to believe that some of those members of the nomenclatura may be thinking about what they want their role in the future to be. So I think the future is open.
Yeah, well, my take on that is that, so the protest per se were not surprising because before the election, we saw that people were gathering around Svetlana Tikhanovskaya around all country, across all country. That also was a new thing. Regions in Belarus were have been passive for decades. And we saw 10,000 people came to the campaign meeting in Brest. 63,000 people were gathered in Minsk. They were kind of, you know, Lukashenko took precautions for the upcoming meetings. But the persistence of the protests were surprising. I agree. So persistence is what we are looking at, and that's what we want. Kind of, you know, everybody who is whose heart is with Belarus and democratization at that point. So it's very important to mention the mistakes to understand what might be. So the mistakes Lukashenko made are at least two. You can talk about more mistakes before the elections, but at least two mistakes, very huge mistakes since August 9, meaning the vote day, the presidential vote, official vote. He claimed 80.1% of the votes, which he did before in all his elections that were always around 80%. But that this time he overdid it because that means he ignored the grassroots movement across the country already, and that angered people. They felt a bit like, you know, that they were lied to. That's one thing. So they went to protest. But the second thing that kind of, you know, activated people who were apolitical was violence. That 7,000 people who were detained and beaten, that touched every person in Belarus. And I'm saying even, it might be even literally, because a friend of a friend's son was beaten, you know, so that's basically the idea. So, and we see the persistence of these protests. And according to social movements theory, movements go through four stages. So basically the beginning, when people are aware of the issue that happened in Belarus. Second one, when they go to the streets and see each other, that also happened in Belarus. Now we are on during the, at the third stage out of four, which is the forces decline of the movement, it's just, it has to decline at some point. Now we are looking at bureaucratization of the movement, meaning there's supposed to be some kind of force that will gain political power and make it possible for the movement's goals to be realized. And that's where we are stuck right now, a little bit. The movements persist. We cannot say they are fading because you see a lot of innovations in Belarusian movement. Every day, people come up with something new. It's, different strata of population. Women in white. Women come with flowers. Women come with tight hands. People sing in subways. People sing in malls. People dance outside and gather more than 250 people, 1,000 people gather only in Minsk. It kind of adds up to 0.5 million people who protest every Sunday. So protests persist, but we are stuck at the bureaucratization stage where the coordination council, which is supposed to kind of bring the dialogue and initiate this transfer, is not recognized by, let's say, Russia for sure. They're saying, we don't know why we should talk to them. They are not, they were not organized in any specific way. They are not who we want to talk with. Lukashenko says, yes, I do not recognize them. I don't want to talk with them. Let's talk with representatives of students. Let's talk with representatives of workers. So basically, that's where we want, kind of, not we want, the movement, whether the bureaucratization will happen or not, that will determine the outcome. The West has been helping as much as they could, but there is no, they don't have this partnership or and cooperation agreement. So they are tied with their efforts, but they are helping with the money and all they can. I mean, it can be more or less, but what I wanted to say, like finish with the point that we are facing economic crisis right now that's going to be coming because the devaluation of the currency has been happening. IT businesses are leaving. Investors have been leaving. Economy has been stagnating. And that will anger people more and they will come and persist, you know, the protests will persist and that will allow time for the government to kind of institutionalize and possibly kind of bring that change. But again, I agree with Margarita that, yes, it remains to be seen still.
Yes, Margarita, you want to follow up?
On one very good point that Tatiana made, which she just said in passing that Belarus does not have a deep and comprehensive free trade agreement with the EU. This is a really important point because one of the ways in which the EU could impact the situation is by using the possibility of closer relations with Belarus as a carrot for bringing in domestic change, for calling for the freeing of political prisoners, new elections, whatever. But Belarus is one of the few countries which has not really made a point of wanting to join the EU, wanting to have closer relations with the EU, as certainly Ukraine tried for many years, not to speak of NATO. So this is one element which really limits the EU's and the West in general ability to influence the situation in Belarus. So I just wanted to emphasize that because that's a really important point. And Tatiana made it as part of a larger discussion, but I think we need to rescue that.
Now, Tatiana, sort of last question here, though, is the impact of other countries. I know there have been some pretty significant protests in the Baltic states, in Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, in trying to reach out. I know others within the region have been trying to bolster the opposition. Obviously, Belarus has had much more of an isolated position vis-a-vis those neighbors recently, but could those movements have any sort of an impact as this political drama plays out? Or is it really much more internal and these are feel-good stories, but probably not likely to have a real strong political impact?
That's a great question. I appreciate you asked it because, like, you know, it's impossible not to mention the word diaspora, you know, that has been having an impact on people on even like it's different even ways, psychological support. But even more important is that people abroad and inside the country gathering money for people who are fired, who suffered. They pay fines when people are arrested. And my friends here, actually, they created this fund that encourages police or law enforcement to defect from the government. And they are saying, if you defect and you kind of show us that it's legit, we will support you and, support you in any ways by training, getting new profession. We will give you the money to survive and all that. Lithuania, as you said, showed incredible support. They are demonstrating it with, the symbols. They did the Baltic, the imitation or kind of repetition, trying to find the correct word, of the Baltic way they had, in their history when they were protesting the Soviet Union, they wanted to be independent, in support of Belarus. And they are supporting the Svetlana Tikhanovskaya right now because she is in Lithuania. And currently, there was an offer to create representations of the coordinating council, which is the body that is not recognized at the moment, outside the country, to give it more power. I'm not sure how that's kind of, it's still discussed. It's very new. It's I think today or yesterday offer by Lithuania to help with that. But besides Lithuania, Poland was also very helpful. Poland, maybe because these are neighboring countries, anybody can say, they have been giving a lot of money and support, and they are saying that we will be opening borders for the people if they need asylum, if they need assistance. They send trucks with humanitarian help. And Czech Republic also send money and support. So basically this, not the European Union as a whole, you know, but several countries individually have been helping a lot. And as I said, diaspora also has been pressuring for sanctions, and they have been doing that for 3 weeks already, maybe even longer. They have been talking and speaking with the officials of the European Union government, you know, the talking to the representatives, calling, and they made a lot of interviews. It's just as Margarita said, and I mentioned, the European Union is limited. The United States, in their turn, is busy with their own internal problems, you know, upcoming elections and COVID and whatnot. But we cannot disregard outside help, outside support. That has been helping, even if you just say like the money, funds, and some people, I know people, myself personally, that have been encouraged by that and kind of, you know, supported the movement.
Absolutely. We will leave with that. Thank you very much to our guests for helping us to unpack some of these key questions and give us the guideposts that we need to be able to follow this story and see as these issues develop. We've discussed today the ongoing political crisis, the presidential election and its aftermath in Belarus. Our guests have been Margarita Balmaseda, professor of diplomacy and international relations at Seton Hall University. She's also associate of the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies and of the Ukrainian Research Institute at Harvard University, and the author of Living the High Life in Minsk, Russian Energy Rents, Domestic Populism, and Belarus's Impending Crisis. And Tatiana Kulikevich, lecturer at the University of South Florida and research fellow at USF's Institute on Russia. She's the author of 20 Years in the Making, Understanding the Difficulty for Change in Belarus. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. You're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Hormones change our brains, according to neuroscientists. What might this mean for women taking birth control pills over the course of their childbearing years? What might these changes be? Belinda Pletzer joins us. She researches neuroendocrinology at the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at the University of Salzburg in Austria. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you here with us. Perhaps where we could start then is actually what the chemicals are in the pill that are having the brain effects. So I've read that the pill actually has multiple chemicals in it. It's not just estrogen and progesterone, and they're finding that they're androgens, anti-androgens, and they're having different effects on the brain. So maybe we can start with actually what is in the pill?
Most pills that are on the market and are most commonly taken are compound contraceptives. So they contain both an estrogen component and a progestin component. And mostly the estrogen component is ethanyl estradiol. It's a very potent estrogen. So it has a higher binding affinity to the estrogen receptors than our natural estradiol. And it also has a longer half-life, so it stays in the blood longer than our natural estradiol. So that's where most of the contraceptives are, or at least most of the oral contraceptives, the pills, where they are similar. And what they where they differ, it's the progestins, because there's many, many different progestins on the market. And as you already mentioned, some of them are androgenic and others are anti-androgenic. Some of them, mostly the older ones, like levonorgestrel, for instance, they were derived from androgens, from 19 nortestosterone, which is a very potent androgen. Researchers have been, also doctors have been trying to get rid of these androgenic properties and make newer progestins. That's why the newest progestins like trospirenone, they don't have these androgenic properties anymore. They are actually anti-androgenic.
So the androgen, anti-androgen properties are the things that are actually changing women's brains that you found, right? Or is it all of the chemicals?
It's all of them. I think that the ethanyl estradiol also has a very strong effect, and that it's very hard in the compound pills to distinguish which effects are attributable to ethanyl estradiol and which are attributable to the progestins. So one approach to this would probably be to compare the androgenic and anti-androgenic ones, and where they have similar effects that could be from the estradiol, that if they have different effects, that could be from the progestin components.
So what are the things that you have found in terms of the way the brain changes?
I have to say that all the results we got were from between subject studies. That means we compared a group of women on the pill to a group of women who are not on the pill. And it's possible that the effects we found are not hormonal effects, but that women who take the pill differ from women who don't take the pill in other aspects. Like, I don't know, social status sometimes, or maybe even personality. So, for instance, what influences your decision to take the pill or not to take the pill? However, I think that since most of our subjects were student and matched in those respects, I am hopeful that that was not the case. So what we found in the first study was that the women who are on the pill have larger gray matter volumes in several brain areas, including the frontal cortex, hippocampus, parahippocampus, and also the cerebellum, for instance.
So before you go on, can you tell us what those would actually have in terms of effects? Like, so what if you have a different hippocampus?
Hippocampus has been implicated in memory, of course, and also in spatial processing, navigation, for instance. Also, the parahippocampus has been implicated in navigation. And the frontal cortex is relevant for tons of things, verbal processing, for instance, emotional processing, inhibitory control, etc., etc. But again, one has to be very careful to conclude from a structural study what the functional implication would be without actually testing that.
Let's go back to these changes then. So you're finding the changes in all these different areas of the brain. And I think I read that it seemed to be masculinizing women in terms of the brain structure. Is that true?
No. Our first interpretation or our first approach was to compare sex differences, so the differences you usually find between men and women, to the differences we found between contraceptive users and non-contraceptive users. And in terms of structure, you have both, because women usually have the higher frontal cortex, whereas men usually have the higher hippocampus and parahippocampus. And if of those areas get larger in the contraceptive users, then you have both effects. But later on, we did a study with number processing tasks, two number processing tasks, where we also compared men to women who don't take the pill, and then women who take the pill to women who don't take the pill. And there we found that the differences between men and naturally cycling women were actually very similar to the differences we found between naturally cycling women and women on the pill, and that women on the pill don't differ from men in their brain activation patterns.
One of the other studies you did actually even looked at how menstrual cycles affect the brains. And so it seems like the pill is affecting the brain, but so is the fluctuation, the normal fluctuation of hormones.
Yes. What you would expect, of course, is that the hormones, the synthetic hormones you have in the pill affect the same brain areas and the same brain function as the natural hormones do, because they bind to the same receptors in the same areas. So that's what you could expect. And for instance, the hippocampus also changes along the menstrual cycle. It's larger in the preovulatory phase when estradiol is high, and the pill also has a high amount of the potent ethinyl estradiol, so that's not so surprising that that would also change. We also found that the hippocampus is larger the longer women have previously been using the pill. So even if they are not currently on the pill anymore, the longer they have previously taken the pill, their hippocampus is still larger.
So in terms of the changes, it doesn't necessarily snap back.
I'm not very comfortable speculating on that right now. But yeah, that's one of the indications that made us wonder whether it would snap back, and gave us the idea that that would be something worthwhile investigating, whether it's actually reversible. Because before that, I think everyone was just assuming, yeah, those effects are temporary. But then if the duration you have been taking this before still affects your brain when you're not taking it anymore, that there might be something lingering, yeah.
So we know that the brain has some plasticity, but we don't know yet how much that change can go one direction and another. I mean, if you think about it, if a woman's menstrual cycle changes her brain, I suppose then you would expect it to then change back, but then...
Yes, it changes back. So if hippocampal gray matter volume increases pre-ovulatory, then it decreases again after ovulation. But that's short-lived. I mean, the pre-ovulatory estradiol peak is only for a day, and then it's gone. That's different than taking the same amount of estrogens day after day for years.
And so generally speaking, we know also that when women's hormones change later in life, that affects the brain.
During menopause, when you lose your estrogen. Yes, I'm not a menopause researcher, but I know people who do that. And menopause, I think it had a research interest peak a few years back, and now it's re-emerging, basically. Probably due to the findings on the pill, I don't know. But I think it's an excellent model also. Any time of hormonal change in a woman's life is an excellent model to study what sex hormones do to our brain. And yet, I think that also for these researchers, the hippocampus is one of the areas where they also find the most interesting effects, like a smaller hippocampi with the loss of estradiol.
So would you say that your findings suggest that the pill may not be brain safe?
No, we don't have enough data to say anything like that. And I would really not want my findings to be distributed that way. The only thing that's important to me is that we should start looking what it does to our brain, because it's a very, very important effect that has been ignored for 50 years. So we need to know that in order to be able to make an informed decision about our contraceptives that we use. I think women have a right to know that.
And there are multiple kinds of contraceptives that you noted.
Yes.
And some are going to have these effects, while some have maybe a different kind of effects.
It's one of the difficulties also that if you study one contraceptive and you find some effects, then that might not necessarily mean that all or other contraceptives have the same effect. That makes it complicated because there's so many different brands on the market. And as a woman, you should ideally know about all of these brands before you decide which one you take. So there's a lot of work still to do, figure out what they all do.
Do you have a sense that your work is changing how we look at contraception?
Yes. I think that at least among sex hormone researchers, the pill is becoming a more and more interesting topic to study, also among brain researchers. And since we did this first study, the structural study I told you about, there's been a lot of other research groups starting to work on the pill. And I think that's a good thing. It's important that we start looking into what it does in our brain. I'm not sure about the public. I mean, there was a lot of public attention to these studies, naturally. I mean, women are interested in what pills do to their brains. And it was, the reactions were quite different. Some thought, oh, my brain areas get bigger, so the pill is a good thing, so I should be taking the pill. Whereas others were, oh, the pill changes my brain, that's a bad thing, so I should stop taking the pill. And I can understand both reactions, but I still think that at the moment we can't make any of these claims because we don't know the functional significance. Also, it was a between subject study. There might still other factors explaining our findings. I mean, we did a follow-up study where the effects were actually much smaller. We still found them, but they were smaller. And also in the frontal cortex, the effects were in the other direction. So it's possible that different populations of women react differently to the pill. That's also something we have to still investigate, figure out the factors in a woman's life that make her susceptible to changes.
What are your next steps in your research?
Well, I want to get away from this between subject designs. I mean, it's easy. You just recruit the women off the street. Because it's a huge experiment running around and I don't have to do anything, basically. They just come into the lab. Now I want to get away from this and I want to capture women when they start taking the pill and when they get off the pill and also get a more detailed history of how long they have been taking the pill, et cetera, et cetera, which is not that easy anymore because you actually have to, find them when they start taking them. And if you also want to control which types of hormones are in the pills they start taking, they often they don't know yet when they decide to go on the pill because they first have to meet their gynecologist and they don't know which brand they will actually be taking.
Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you very much.
Belinda Pletzer researches neuroendocrinology at the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at the University of Salzburg in Austria.
Thank you to our guest and to you for listening. The Scholar Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.